Welcome to the debate. So imagine the person holding the keys to attorney discipline in New York is sharing a private practice, you know, an office and profits, with a lawyer who is secretly vacationing in Mexico with the judge presiding over her cases.
I mean, you'd think it was a bad legal thriller.
Right. It really sounds like one. But that is the exact reality currently shaking the foundation of the Ninth Judicial District.
Yeah, it's a massive system in crisis.
It is. And we're drawing our analysis today from a formal complaint published by the Ethics Reporter on March 10, 2026. The facts are just stark. Former Supreme Court Justice Sherry L. Eisenpress permanently resigned after a huge misconduct scandal.
Mm-hmm. She was caught presiding over cases involving attorneys she had, well, undisclosed intimate social relationships with.
Exactly. And the central figure in that web, Amy M. Eisenberg. She appeared in 18 cases before the judge, failing to disclose their relationship in 17 of them.
Wow. 17 cases.
Yeah, 17. All while sharing international vacations and, you know, sexually graphic group texts.
And to be clear on the stakes here, the controversy isn't just about what Eisenberg did. It's about who her business partner is.
Right. Susan G. Yellen.
Yes. The co-founding partner of Eisenberg Yellen, LLP. But she is also the chair of the grievance committee for the Ninth Judicial District. I mean, she is literally the chief ethics enforcer.
Which brings us to the central question we are tackling today. Can Susan G. Yellen remain impartial as the chair of this committee given her firm's deep implication in the scandal?
Right.
And more importantly, because her disciplinarian role is a public position entirely supported by taxpayer dollars, must she be explicitly ordered to step down immediately? My position is that she absolutely must.
Okay.
When the structural integrity of a self-policing system is compromised, allowing a disciplinarian to remain in power while her own firm is implicated, well, it destroys public trust. Her failure to supervise or report her partner's actions violates foundational ethical rules. It just makes her position untenable.
And I will argue that preemptively ordering her removal before an evidentiary hearing, it actually subverts the very due process this system is built on.
How so?
Well, it establishes a highly dangerous precedent of guilt by association. We have established insulation protocols, mechanisms specifically designed for handling conflicts at the highest levels, and we must use them. Bypassing those legal frameworks just to appease public outrage is what truly damages the integrity of the institution.
Let's ground this in the reality of what it means to be the chair of a grievance committee, though. Yellen holds quasi-judicial authority over every single attorney across five counties: Westchester, Rockland, Orange, Putnam, and Dutchess.
It's a huge jurisdiction.
It really is. She has the power to initiate formal disciplinary charges, to ruin careers, and to recommend disbarment. Yet every day she walks into a law firm where she shares a letterhead, a client base, and the firm's profits with an attorney who engaged in a six-year pattern of deception.
Listeners hearing about text chains named Punta Cana Partiers or Bougie Bitches might think this sounds like a reality television show.
Yeah, a really bad one.
Right, but the legal reality is devastating for the litigants whose cases were rigged.
Nobody is defending Eisenberg's conduct. Denying litigants an impartial tribunal is a profound violation.
A complete violation of the rules prohibiting conduct prejudicial to the administration of justice.
Exactly.
When you strip people of a neutral judge, you aren't just breaking a procedural rule, you are breaking the foundational promise of the court.
Right. And under Rule 5.1 of our professional conduct rules, Yellen has a strict supervisory responsibility. Under Rule 8.3a, she has a duty to report misconduct.
I hear that, but you are trying to apply a standard of strict liability to a law partnership. And that fundamentally misrepresents how these rules work in practice. We need definitional precision regarding knowledge under Rule 8.3a.
Well, the rule requires reporting when an attorney knows that another attorney has committed a violation. Are you suggesting she didn't know?
I am suggesting we don't have the evidence yet to prove she did. Holding Yellen strictly liable for Eisenberg's undisclosed social life and private text messages is just a massive overreach. But Partners in a law firm are not omniscient. They do not audit each other's out-of-office vacation itineraries to see if a judge happens to be at the same Vidanta resort in Mexico.
I see why you think that, but let me give you a different perspective. Think about a corporate audit. If the CFO is caught embezzling millions of dollars, the CEO does not get to oversee the internal investigation.
But this isn't embezzlement, it's...
You are framing this as if Eisenberg's misconduct was a private after-hours hobby that had nothing to do with the firm. It had everything to do with the firm.
How so?
We are talking about 18 cases over 6 years before the exact same judge. Let's talk about the mechanics of how a modern law firm operates. You don't just walk into a courtroom anonymously.
No, obviously there's paperwork.
Right. Cases are entered into shared case management software. Conflicts of interest are checked in a centralized database. The firm's docket would clearly show a massive footprint of cases assigned to Justice Eisenpress.
Sure, but...
The billing software would reflect it. How does a co-founding partner miss 18 cases?
I come at it from a different way. You miss them because the misconduct isn't the caseload itself. The misconduct is an omission.
An omission?
Yes. Eisenberg failed to disclose a social relationship to opposing counsel while standing in a courtroom. How exactly does a partner supervise an omission in a room they aren't physically standing in?
Well...
A docket entry in the firm's software showing a case assigned to Justice Eisenpress isn't a red flag on its own. Lawyers appear before the same judges all the time. You know, that's the nature of local practice. You are conflating the existence of the caseload with explicit knowledge of the secret relationship.
But I am looking at the totality of the circumstances. Yellen either knew about this 6-year pattern of deception and remained silent, which makes her complicit.
Or
she was completely oblivious to a massive systemic ethical breach happening right under her nose, which makes her incompetent to serve as the chief ethics enforcer for 5 counties. Neither scenario allows her to sit at the head of the disciplinary table.
But this is exactly why the American Bar Association drafted Model Rule 18. The rules already contemplate situations where a board member is the subject of a complaint or hopelessly conflicted.
Right, but...
The prescribed remedy in the model rules is that the Chief Justice appoints a special independent board. It does not say automatically dissolve the member's standing based on a third-party formal complaint.
The Model Rule 18 assumes a functional, contained conflict. We have to look at the structural reality here. True impartiality is mathematically impossible.
Mathematically impossible?
Yes. Think of the grievance committee like a biological immune system. Its entire purpose is to seek out and destroy ethical pathogens in the legal profession. If the white blood cells themselves are compromised by the virus, the body cannot heal.
Okay, I appreciate the immune system metaphor, but if you have an autoimmune response where you preemptively attack your own healthy cells, meaning your own procedural safeguards and due process, the system dies anyway.
I don't think asking for a resignation is an autoimmune response.
Forcing a resignation based on association bypasses the procedural protections that exist to prevent disciplinary systems from being weaponized.
It's not weaponization when the public is footing the bill. This is where the mandate for her removal becomes overwhelming, and it comes down to a legal concept that doesn't get enough attention, quasi-judicial immunity.
Which is essential for the committee to function.
Left unchecked, grievance committee members enjoy absolute judicial immunity from civil liability for duties performed in connection with their grievance work.
Right, federal courts have firmly established this.
Exactly. That means if you are a litigant whose life was ruined in one of those rigged Eisenpress cases, you cannot sue the chair of the grievance committee in civil court for failing to discipline her own partner. The disciplinary process itself is literally the only avenue for accountability.
Which makes the disciplinary process incredibly important, yes.
And this entire apparatus, the staff attorneys, the investigators, the office space, is funded entirely by New York taxpayers.
Mm-hmm. When the public realizes they are paying for a system where the chief disciplinarian is financially tied to the biggest misconduct scandal in the district, they have an absolute right to demand her immediate removal. Leaving her in place doesn't just look bad. You know, it creates the structural appearance of a state-funded cover-up.
That's a compelling argument, but have you considered that public funding actually demands strict adherence to procedure, not mob justice?
Mob justice is a bit strong.
Is it?
Taxpayers fund this system to uphold procedural fairness and the rule of law. When you advocate for immediate removal, you are demanding an administrative execution before an evidentiary hearing has even taken place.
The public has a right to accountability.
Will the formal complaint published by the Ethics Reporter explicitly ask for the appointment of independent counsel or a special committee? That is the correct mechanism. We use the insulation protocols that those taxpayers funded.
But how can the public trust an independent committee if the person being investigated still holds the title of chair?
Because states handle this all the time without burning the house down. Look at North Carolina's delegation model.
Right, where the duties are delegated.
Exactly. The chair's duties are legally delegated to someone else when they are disqualified from a specific matter. The authority is paused, legally walled off.
But she's still the chair.
Yes, but if we remove Yellen preemptively without utilizing the special committee protocol, we are telling the public that our own ethical rules and procedural safeguards are insufficient. We would be signaling that when the political heat gets turned up, the rule book gets thrown out the window.
I just disagree. There is a massive difference between throwing out the rulebook and recognizing when a leader has lost the moral authority to lead.
I think it does far more damage to institutional integrity than allowing an established, independent investigative process to run its course.
Following the rules doesn't mean preserving a compromised official in a position of supreme authority while their firm is audited.
But look, we are only looking at half the picture here.
What do you mean? We've been debating Yellen's passive complicity in her partner's scandal. We need to expand the lens to the direct allegations against Yellen herself, which are detailed in the source material.
Oh, you're referring to the online reviews.
Specifically, two unresolved Avvo.com reviews. And we cannot gloss over the severity of what is alleged here. One of these reviews explicitly claims that Yellen convinced a client to suborn perjury.
It's an internet review.
Let's talk about the human stakes of that, though. The client alleges Yellen urged them to embellish a domestic violence story during a highly contentious matrimonial proceeding.
Right.
She allegedly told the client to claim her husband stalked her with a knife when the actual incident was a physical argument that involved no weapon at all. Now, I anticipate your skepticism about internet reviews.
I am highly skeptical, yes.
But put that aside for a second and look at the gravity of the claim. Suborning perjury regarding a deadly weapon in a domestic violence case doesn't just break a rule. It weaponizes the court against an innocent party. Doesn't the mere existence of public allegations of subornation of perjury against the chair of the grievance committee create an insurmountable appearance of impropriety?
I'm sorry, but I just don't buy that. Let me tell you why. It absolutely does not, and treating it as if it does would destroy the legal profession.
Destroy it? That's a bit hyperbolic.
Let me explain why we cannot use an Avvo review to topple a public official. We are talking about matrimonial law. It is notoriously, inherently toxic. Divorces and custody battles are arguably the most emotionally volatile proceedings in our entire justice system.
I don't disagree with that.
Right. People lose their children, their homes, their life savings. Disgruntled litigants, both opposing parties and sometimes even an attorney's own clients, frequently weaponize anonymous or quasi-anonymous consumer platforms.
But these aren't just complaints about being overbilled or unreturned phone calls. This is a specific allegation of manufacturing a felony to win a custody dispute.
Which makes it the perfect lie for a disgruntled client to tell if they want to destroy their lawyer's career. If we validate internet complaints by ordering the resignation of a public official based on unverified, unadjudicated online reviews, we will completely destabilize the quasi-judicial authority of any disciplinary chair in the country.
I understand that, but
think about the mechanics of what you're proposing. Anyone with a keyboard and a grudge could force the resignation of the chief ethics enforcement officer simply by posting a horrific allegation online.
I'm not minimizing the risk of that.
Rule 3.3 regarding candor toward the tribunal is incredibly serious. Suborning perjury is a career-ending violation. I am not minimizing the severity of the charge. But an allegation on a website is not evidence of a Rule 3.3 violation. It is text on a screen.
I completely understand the danger of anonymous internet mobs. But you are treating these elements in isolation rather than looking at the totality of the circumstances. We are not talking about a random attorney dealing with a bad Yelp review. We are talking about the chair of the grievance committee.
I know who we're talking about.
The standard for the appearance of impropriety for this specific role must be astronomically higher than for a private practitioner.
Higher standards still require evidence.
Well, let's look at the evidence of the firm's culture then. When the commission administrator, Robert H. Tembikchin, announced Justice Eisenpress's resignation, he didn't mince words. He stated, her permanent removal was the only appropriate resolution to maintain the integrity of the unified court system. Why shouldn't that exact same logic apply to the law firm that was intimately involved in corrupting her? The intersection of Eisenberg's proven documented misconduct, you know, 17 rigged cases, the international vacations, the group chats,
right,
combined with the firm's shared liability under ethical rules and the publicly funded nature of the grievance committee, it makes Yellen's continued role as chair impossible to justify. You are asking taxpayers to trust a system that is actively investigating its own boss.
The critical distinction you are missing is the timeline of due process. Justice Eisenpress's resignation came after a formal investigation.
True.
It came after formal charges were drafted by the Commission on Judicial Conduct. There was an established factual record that resulted in a legal stipulation. You are asking for Yellen's head before the factual record regarding her knowledge or involvement has even been gathered.
Because the structural conflict demands it.
You are combining a partner's proven judicial misconduct with an unverified internet review, rolling them into a ball and using it to justify an immediate expulsion. That abandons the standard of evidence entirely.
It doesn't abandon the standard of evidence. It acknowledges the reality of structural conflicts of interest. If a bank president is credibly accused of massive fraud, the board of directors doesn't leave them in charge of the bank while the auditors go through the books.
Okay, but
they are placed on leave or they are forced to resign to protect the institution's stock and public confidence.
And the legal equivalent of placing them on leave is ABA Model Rule 1-8. Appointing an independent special committee walls off the conflict without executing the accused before the trial.
I just don't think a wall is enough here.
Institutional integrity is maintained through the rigorous, dispassionate application of existing rules, not by panicking when the optics get ugly. If we believe the disciplinary system is robust enough to handle the attorneys involved in the Eisenpress scandal,
which it was,
and it clearly was, given her resignation, then we must believe it is robust enough to handle this complaint using the special board provisions that were designed for this exact nightmare scenario. We do not protect the system by tossing out its leaders based on association.
I think we have hit the core philosophical divide here. We both clearly agree on the sheer gravity of the underlying Eisenpress and Eisenberg misconduct scandal.
Without a doubt.
The systemic failure to provide an impartial tribunal to litigants across those 18 cases is a permanent stain on the Ninth Judicial District. And I know we are in complete agreement that a special independent investigation into Yellen and her firm is absolutely warranted to protect whatever public trust is left.
Absolutely. The necessity of public trust in legal discipline cannot be overstated. When citizens walk into a courtroom, they have to believe the game isn't rigged.
Exactly.
Where we remain in firm disagreement is on the sequencing and the mechanism of accountability. I maintain that utilizing existing structural safeguards, specifically appointing an independent committee, is the only way to investigate the disciplinarian without trampling on the due process that the system was built to uphold.
And I maintain that when the person under scrutiny holds the keys to the disciplinary kingdom, a kingdom funded by taxpayers and shielded by absolute civil immunity, their immediate removal is a necessary prerequisite.
Even without an evidentiary hearing?
Yes. You cannot assure the public that an investigation is credible while the target of the investigator still possesses the power to destroy the careers of the investigators. The intersection of private law partnerships and public disciplinary roles requires an exceptional, almost ruthless level of scrutiny.
It certainly exposes how incredibly complex the application of our ethical rules becomes when the enforcers themselves are thrust under the microscope. It tests whether we actually believe in our own procedural safeguards.
It really is the ultimate stress test for a self-policing profession. There is a vast amount of detail in the source material regarding the specific commission findings, the intricate ethical rules cited, and the reality of how these local courts operate.
Yeah, it's a fascinating read.
It is well worth exploring to weigh the balance of accountability for yourself. because ultimately it brings us back to the core dilemma of any system of authority. If the immune system meant to protect the public from corruption is itself compromised, we have to ask whether the legal profession is truly equipped to recognize and cure its own blind spots. Thank you for joining us on The Debate.